This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we are scheduled to hear from Kareem Balci, a editor of the Turkish Review, an international bi-monthly magazine for global readership, and he also writes for the largest circulated Turkish daily. He has some thoughts about journalism in Turkey and in the Middle East, and we'll hear from Bob Mann, LSU Mass Communications professor, as well. Former Supreme Court Chief Justice Kitty Kimball is slated to be with us. She has recently retired, and we'll hear from her about one of her latest endeavors. And also, Marianne Sternberg. Her book is River Road Rambler, a curious traveler along Louisiana's historic byway. Marianne takes us to fascinating places between New Orleans and Baton Rouge on River Road. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number, and outside our area it is 877-217-5757. And you may also reach us via email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We're joined in studio by a gentleman who reports internationally from Turkey, Kareem Balci. He is the editor-in-chief of the Turkish Review. And Bob Mann is his host from the LSU School of Mass Communication, the Manship School. Good morning to both of you gentlemen.
Good morning.
Morning.
And Bob, why don't you tell us how Kareem got to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, of all places?
Well, we're honored to have him. He will be spending the morning at the Manship School at LSU speaking to journalism students. We don't often get to hear from international journalists. And so it's a rare treat for our students to get to meet someone of his stature who knows so much about Turkish politics and the politics of the Middle East and of a region that is very, very important to not only geopolitically, but very important to the United States and its interests. And tonight he will be speaking at a friendship dinner sponsored by the Atlas Center, which is a group of Turkish Americans and Baton Rougeans who are interested in interfaith and intercultural dialogue. So we're really honored to have him here with us today.
How much freedom of the press is there in Turkey?
Well, by means of speaking, there is freedom. But when it comes to writing on issues that relates to the so-called Armenian genocide issues or that relates to Kurdish separatist movements, unfortunately, the Turkish situation is still yet to improve. I always say if we compare Turkey's situation to 10 years before, it is improving, it is better. But if you compare Turkey to Western democracies, there is a long road to go.
And some journalists go to jail for what they write and speak, don't they?
Yes. It is said that about 90 journalists are in jail, and this is a huge number. But as I said, compared to 10 years ago, 10 years ago they were killed. So they are now at least alive.
So that's an improvement?
Yes, that is a real improvement. Our listeners shouldn't think of Turkey with the Western standards. We had an era of state-controlled terrorism in Turkey where journalists propagating a separation of Kurdish minority from the country were actually assassinated. We don't still know by whom, but they were assassinated. We have a huge number of journalists killed between 1980s and 2000s, but in the last 12 years, we have no such occasion. That is an improvement, indeed. Mm-hmm.
The Secretary of State of the United States, John Kerry, was in Istanbul this week. How was that covered in Turkey?
By means of the coverage of Secretary of State's visit, the issue was mainly the promised visit of Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan to Gaza. It is seen that the United States wants to have the control during that visit, if it will ever happen. And the U.S. wants to make it sure that the Turkish support for the Gazan people won't turn into a Turkish support for the Hamas government in Gaza. Hamas is still a U.S.-listed terrorist organization, and the U.S. understandably doesn't want to see one of his prime allies in the region create a new alliance with that terrorist organization. The coverage was mainly a kind of dichotomous coverage. Some of the people who are supporting the government regards the United States' engagement in this issue as a kind of blocking way in front of Turkey's surging foreign policy activism in the region. But the press that is already in the opposition to AK Party's activism in Muslim countries, particularly in support of Muslim Brotherhood Party, are happy.
What do you make of the reports about the tragedy in Boston that focus upon the religion of the assailants? Obviously, some folks will take it personally one way or the other regarding the fact that these two men apparently were of the Muslim faith. Is that something that we should paint with a broad brush, or is that discrimination that is present in the United States?
Well, if we say the fact that those people were officially of Muslim religion means something about Islam, that is a discrimination. But if we say that there is a problem out there, because each time we have a terrorism issue, it comes out of a certain branch of Islam, and this needs to be tackled. This is obviously a necessary observation. And this, I believe, is not only an issue of the West itself, but it is an issue of the Muslim world itself also. The Muslim world needs to take care of its own children. Today I was watching an American TV. A father was claiming his son, who was planning to join Al-Qaeda, was the best son he could ever have. Now we need to ask this question. It says that good people can be also turned into terrorists, and this is a real challenge for the modern world. This is a challenge for the Muslim world also. As a Turkish person, you know, I was on that day in the news department. We heard of the bombing, and my associate editor actually is a marathon runner, so it became suddenly our own issue. She was planning to run in London Marathon, and we all started to cry, and we all started to pray to some extent, that this one won't be a Muslim person, you know. So you have to understand the psychology in the Muslim world also. Whenever a terrorist attack activity happens here and there, the Muslims are pushed in the edge of feeling guilty. At such a situation, the American public needs to take care of the issue with a little bit more understanding that this is not hurting only the American public or the world, but also to the Muslim world.
On the issue of freedom of the press and access, Bob, I see another story today about a court challenge to try to get the names of those who applied, at least the finalists of those who were in the hunt to be LSU president before F. King Alexander was chosen. We give lip service to freedom of the press in the United States, but obviously there's some miles to travel.
That's true, and we do, Americans, spend a lot of time lecturing other countries about the way they ought to open up their press, but sometimes our own press is not as open. Our own access to government information is not as open as it ought to be and as we would want it to be, and we see here in Louisiana that all it takes sometimes is an administration who is determined not to release information and to cover up information, to conceal information about the activities of government, and we find out that maybe the press is not as powerful as it thinks it is in prying this information out of government officials. It takes a lawsuit, and we still don't know whether that lawsuit will be successful or not.
But is it somewhat of a curious development that the 21-year-old editor of the Reveille is suing the LSU Board of Supervisors to get information that rightfully belongs to the people of Louisiana?
Well, I think that it's I'm happy she's doing that, and I'm happy that the Advocate and the Times-Picayune have basically joined in that suit in support of her. But I think it's what student journalists ought to do. It's what journalists in Turkey and other parts of the world are doing at much greater jeopardy to their livelihood and even to their life and freedom than we have. I mean, Andrea Gallo, who's the editor of the Reveille, can file that suit and know that she will not be kicked out of school, that she is not going to be harmed in any way. There's a lot of countries in this world where journalists who do that would probably disappear the next day. Thankfully, as Mr. Balci has said, Turkey is changing, and it's not so much that way there anymore. But it wasn't all that long ago that something like that in a country like Turkey could get you in a lot of trouble.
Well, and I would imagine if you were teaching at a university where your statements were not met with approval, you might not be teaching there any longer. You do have tenure, Bob Mann, I hope.
I do.
So you're speaking out against the university here by criticizing the Board of Supervisors, which also includes a newspaper publisher. That's an interesting thing that there's a newspaper publisher on the Board of Supervisors who has not released the names to the public he serves.
Well, I don't know that that's his position or what he's
urged his
colleagues
names.
To do, but...
He knows the names. He could
That's true.
Just print them.
But I do think that a lot of people would agree that the highest paid public official in the state of Louisiana should not be hired in a secret process.
The highest paid public official is Les Miles.
Well, the person being paid the most money out of state funds is going to be King Alexander. Les Miles makes a lot of money, but it comes from the LSU Athletic Foundation, the Tiger Athletic Foundation. This man makes more money than anybody in the state of Louisiana out of state funds, and he was hired in a very secretive process.
Well, and the statements by some of the board members that it wasn't secret, that this was done in open view. Well, how did they come to the conclusion that F. King Alexander was the man?
Well, they did that in secret. When they say their process was open, they mean that they actually discussed their secretive process openly. It doesn't mean that we actually got to watch the process in action. It means that they discussed their secret process in open meetings, which is really absurd, and it says that they think we're all pretty stupid.
Well, Bob, on his blog, has recently released 15 rules for politicians and, quote, their flacks. And the last one is you may think your job is to protect your boss and his or her reputation and advance his or her political agenda. It's not. You are, in essence, an officer of the court. You have a client, but your first duty is to the integrity of the system. Remember that when a reporter plops an unpleasant public records request on your desk, she's not asking for your records. She's asking for her records. And the records of the people who applied to be president of the university LSU system, those are the people's records, right?
Those absolutely are the people's records. They are, and I think it's way too easy for people working for these politicians to forget that. And a lot of times they forget it because they, number one, have no fundamental belief in the value and the importance of open government. But number two, a lot of them, most of them, who I think take that attitude, have never worked a day as a journalist, and they don't know what it's like to be on the other side of that equation. They don't know what it's like to spend a day working as a journalist, and they're more political operatives than they are public information officers, and someone ought to remind them of that, and they ought to be required to be not solicitous to journalists. Journalists are citizens. They're representing the citizenry. You and I have the same right to walk into any office in Baton Rouge of state government and demand records. Those are not rights that are just reserved for journalists. Those are rights that are reserved for citizens.
And we thump our chests about how great we are in the United States, but as stated, we have some miles to go. And we can learn a lot from reporting abroad. I know you've spent a lot of time in Turkey, Bob.
I have. And you know, I what we were we were just talking about is Turkey's got a very vibrant media, very vibrant newspaper culture there, much stronger in many ways than we do. They still value the written word in ways that we don't.
Well, we'll hold that thought. We'll return with Bob Mann and Kareem Balji, and also hear from former Chief Justice Kitty Kimball of the Louisiana Supreme Court when we return after this pause. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with Bob Mann, the noted journalist and now professor of mass communication at Louisiana State University and a prominent blogger about Louisiana politics. And there's much to blog about these days. You said we could learn much from the way news is reported in Turkey. Do Turkish journalists, Kareem and Bob, do you hold your politicians' feet to the fire the way we sometimes do and sometimes don't in the United States?
Yes, indeed. The Turkish media is different from the United States media or Western media in one sense. We do have national newspapers, more than 100 national newspapers, meaning published all around the country. The Western readership is basically concerned about things happening in their neighborhood. But the Turkish people, even the people in the remote areas of the country, in the villages, are interested in what's going on in the capital city, in Ankara. And the rumors within politics, relates to everybody. Who is going to be the next chief of staff of the army? People speak about these issues. If there's going to be any kind of shifting in the ministerial post, people care about these things. So the Turkish reporting environment is a highly politicized environment. In the last 10 years, something extra was added into this. Before 10 years ago, the Turkish readership or listeners were mainly interested in domestic issues of Turkey, economics, health industry, and so on. But for the last 10 years, the Turkish people started to speak about global affairs, international issues, starting from the surrounding areas of Turkey, meaning post-Ottoman states, but also on international issues. So go to Turkey today and you will find people speaking about Turkish-Israeli relations, how Turkey is trying to improve a deteriorated relationship. Go to Turkey, people will criticize the government because of its open support to Muslim Brotherhood-related groups in all the Arab Spring countries. Go to Turkey and you will find the people criticizing government for lack of support for the Uyghur population in Western China and so on. So the audience is changing in Turkey, and this is also changing the journalistic behaviors. We do have certain newspapers who were used to be defined as marginal newspapers, meaning using very harsh words in criticizing the government officials and so on. But these marginal newspapers are day by day turning into main mass media in Turkey. So things are changing, and the I can say the journalists are more and more open-speaking people in Turkey.
Bob, we have a question from Brad who asks if the media treated Governor Blanco differently than the media are treating Governor Jindal as far as coverage and vigilance. You were Blanco's
I was
top.
Governor Blanco's communications director. I think in many ways they are, but I think it's a consequence of not how the media have changed, but how the governor and his staff treat the media. I was having a conversation with a reporter yesterday, and just the hostility, the venomous hostility that reporters trying to cover this administration encounter, and that is bound to have an influence on how the coverage is shaped. I won't say that every encounter that we had under Governor Blanco with a reporter was all sweetness and light, but I think that we did our best to treat them with respect and recognize that they had a role to play. And is a very important role in our society.
Did want to play a cut to Kevin yesterday at the Baton Rouge Press Club. Jim Bernhardt spoke, the former chair of the Shaw Group, who recently sold his company for $3 billion, publicly traded company. Jim didn't get all of the $3 billion, but It was a substantial transaction. Baton Rouge is only Fortune 500 company. Shaw is now CBI, and Jim Bernhardt may very well run for governor. Here's what he had to say about the governor's, at this point, his refusal to accept the federal Medicaid money under Obamacare.
What happens if we say, take your $400 million and send it back? And I believe we did that with $80 million for workman's compensation insurance, only to have, when we turn that down, and if you'll check these numbers, I believe it cost the state of Louisiana $120 million. You guys know the exact numbers. The last time we sent money back to Washington cost us an extra 40. So what this is going to cost us in absolute terms is when a mother has a baby that's uninsured and has pneumonia going to the emergency room, that baby's going to be taken care of. And the taxes we pay here and the insurance premiums that we pay here are going to go up to pay for that. So we're not going to pay for it once. We're absolutely, unequivocally going to pay for it twice. And when they talk about business, I can say this with absolute certainty, they don't always look, they look at the tax structure, but that is not the overriding thing what business looks at in locating jobs in a community. One of the things they look at is the health care cost.
All right. That ultimately, I think, may be the biggest issue out of this session.
It could be. It turns out that the tax plan went nowhere, so this sort of fills that vacuum, and it will come to a head potentially this week, whether the legislature truly is independent of this governor and understands better than he does that that we need to accept this federal money that would ensure perhaps as many as 400,000 working individuals and families in this state. These are not people who don't have jobs. These are the working poor who make actually too much money right now to qualify for Medicaid. These aren't shiftless freeloaders, as the governor portrayed them in his op-ed piece that ran in the Opelousas paper on Sunday. These are working Americans who just make too much money.
Did he really say shiftless freeloaders?
Well, he said there are too many people riding the wagon and not enough people pulling it, which sounded very much like someone who thinks that these are people who are looking for a handout and who are not willing to work for a living, when in fact these are working poor.
Looking for a hand up, not a handout. Kobe, final question for Bob. How do you think the Jindal team will react to the national media if he decides to run for a higher office? If he runs for president, how will his campaign staff and his media handlers work the national media?
Well,
will they
same
way they've done the Louisiana media?
Well, they better not, but this is what has always confused me, why this governor is so afraid of interactions with the media, why they protect him so much, why they are so determined to keep him away and avoid any unpleasant interaction with a reporter. If they think that dealing with the Advocate and the Picayune is tough, wait till they get to the national scene when he's on the campaign trail in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, and he's talking to Politico, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, the Los Angeles Times. That'll make the Picayune and the Advocate look like a day in the park. He's not going to be well-versed in how to deal with the media if he doesn't start doing it here better.
You said his campaign last year, if he'd been vice president, would have been blown up by one word, exorcism.
Yeah.
Do you believe that?
I believe that, not because of the exorcism part, but because of the fact that that he would have been paired with Mitt Romney, a Mormon, and I think it would have raised religion to a height in that campaign much higher than Romney wanted it to be, and I think that's one of the reasons why they didn't put him on the ticket. Not the only reason, but I think it was a reason.
Okay. Thank you, Bob Mann. Thank you, Kareem Balji. Hope you enjoy your stay in Baton Rouge, and thanks for sharing your insights with us. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
297-5633 is your number, and we're about to be joined by former Chief Justice Kitty Kimball, Supreme Court of Louisiana. In 1992, she became the first woman elected to the state's highest court. Before that, in 1983, Kitty Kimball was the first female judge in the 18th Judicial District. Native of Alexandria, received her LSU law degree in 1970. Currently lives in Ventris with her husband, former state lawmaker Clyde Kimball. Good to see you, Clyde, by the way, and nice to see you, Justice Kimball. It's It's great to talk to Supreme Court Chief Justice. I don't get to do that often.
Well, I'm not that anymore.
I think from a honorary point, you're always going to be that. That's what you will be known for. And you had quite a tenure on the high court. 1992 to 2012, 20 years. I'm sure you you saw our city, our state, our country evolve a great deal during that time. What were the biggest moments as far as being on the court? Any particular cases or people, did they stand out above all others?
Not really, because for the Supreme Court to deal with a case, it's usually pretty important to the citizens, because that's kind of what we look at when we choose which cases to deal with. So they're all pretty important.
When you go into that court in New Orleans, that majestic building, I'm sure you realize every day how important the work is as far as developing law or judging law in the state and ultimately for all the people who live here.
Most definitely.
And you have spoken many years and many times while being a Supreme Court Justice about honesty and I remember once I saw you speak at Southern University, and you encouraged all the students to be honest when they filled out their applications for law school, because if they lied then, that could come back to bite them years later.
It surely would. That's one of the most important things, is that they, you know, tell everybody exactly who they are when they make an application to the bar, because it will, more than many other things, it really will come back and perhaps prohibit them from being able to be sworn in as a lawyer even after they pass the bar.
You had some health issues, and you've come back with amazing strength. It's been a process, though, hasn't it?
It has been a process. I still have a few lingering issues, but I'm so very fortunate that I'm able to do what I can do.
And the last time we had a Kimball on this show, it was your son.
Oh, yes.
He's doing very well.
And he was talking, I'm sure, about food.
He was. He's the man who runs the show at Ribs, so mm-hmm. he's doing well. And you're involved with a few different philanthropic endeavors, and one in particular this week I know you have near to your heart.
Yes. We have Thursday night a gala to support the Kabonal Mission in Haiti, to try to help the people of Haiti recover from, well, from many things that they've been through, not the least of which is the earthquake in 2010.
And that's this Thursday night here in Baton Rouge.
Thursday night at the Renaissance Hotel.
Certainly a worthy function at the Renaissance in the Grand Ballroom. And by the way, for those who haven't been there, that is a spectacular venue. And it's a silent auction included, and I know there's some items that are quite prominent as far as those that are available, and it's for a worthy cause.
It's a very worthy cause, and there's a silent auction and a live auction and a meal prepared by Chef John Foltz.
And I see among others involved in this, in addition to Kitty and Clyde Kimball, is one Leo Honeycutt. Who's always somewhere when there's a major event happening, and this is to raise money for the people afflicted by the tragedies in Haiti. And Leo, why don't you step the microphone for a moment? I'm looking for my list, but among the live auction items, you mentioned to me that there is a 24-carat gold.
Well, actually, it's a 7-carat. Diamond tennis bracelet that's valued at just under $20,000.
All right. Well,
and of course, this is a no reserve bidding process. If you bid $2,000 and you're the high bid, you're going to get it for $2,000.
So that's among the items available for those who participate in the auction.
And there's trips all over the world too, for everything from France to Hawaii to Alaska.
Yeah.
So it's really a lot of. This is one of the best lists for auction items I've ever been involved with.
And as noted, this is to support poor families in Haiti, and the Haiti mission has been led by an Abbeville priest. Do you know Father Glenn Moak, Kitty Kimball?
I know him only through email. He and I have been emailing back and forth for a while, but I've not met him personally. I will do that, of course, on Thursday.
And he's been doing this for over 20 years. The mission lifts up the poor through a holistic approach, including housing, education, feeding programs, microloans, job training, clean water and nourishment, just the basic necessities
just
of life.
Things that we take for granted every day in our country.
In that country, before the earthquake that happened a few years ago, it already was facing some major challenges.
Yes, that country is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, with 80% of the people living below poverty. And it's just a very, very poor grouping of people.
Do you think we take it for granted how well we have it
in the United States? I think that we do. I don't know of anyone who wakes up and is really thankful for having clean water to drink. You know, it's just something that you kind of take for granted. I mean, I'm sure we all should be thankful that we have clean water to drink, but I doubt that there are very many people that think of that in this country.
David in St. Francisville. Good morning, David. You're on the air with Justice Kimball.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Clyde. Good morning, Judd.
Good morning.
Jim, I had the honor of working with Judge Kimball when she was on the district bench over in the 1850s. And I have a question. After all these years about us lawyers, I'd like to know from Judge Kimball what it is that she thinks that we lawyers in Louisiana should be most proud of in terms of the practice of law, and what Judge Kimball would like to see us most change. Thank you, and it's nice to hear your voice, Judge Kimball.
Oh, glad to hear from you, David. I think that one of the things, at least, that the bar can really be proud of is the work that they do through the Louisiana Bar Foundation. The Bar Foundation, as you know, uses IOLTA funds to fund things around the state that are worthy. They fund lawyers for people who can't afford lawyers. They fund many, many things around the state. And I think that is one of the things that we do quite well in Louisiana. And to improve, you know, I guess, and I may be speaking to the law schools instead of the bar here a little bit, but I think any judge will tell you that they really would like to see lawyers, when they first begin practicing, be more competent, and maybe even at the Supreme Court level. It's wonderful when you see a lawyer that really knows about their case and what they're doing. Not so wonderful when people don't know those things.
Well, Thursday night you can see Justice Kimball along with former State Representative Clyde Kimball and many others, including Leo Honeycutt, at the Renaissance, 6 o'clock, and the gala will make a difference for 62 families or 62 homes for families in need. That's where the funds will go. And Leo, for those who would like to participate, tickets and that sort, what's the best way to do it?
We have a website, and I think we can post that, probably do the connection to your website. But basically at this point, this being Tuesday, if you just come to it, you will sell tickets at the door.
All right.
So most of the floor has been taken, but, you know, and one thing we're all involved with as far as, because this really is a almost singularly Louisiana event. Father Mo had this idea long before the earthquake, and he happened to be there when the earthquake hit. So it's a Louisiana effort.
6 o'clock, Thursday night, Renaissance. Thank you, Justice Kimball. Great to see you. Back after this 90-second timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number, and inkstershow@wrkf.org if you'd like to reach us by email. We're joined in studio by Marianne Sternberg, who is a person who is no stranger to WRKF, a great supporter of this radio station, and a prominent person in our community, and a prolific writer, particularly about River Road. That's her latest work, River Road Rambler, a curious traveler along Louisiana's historic byway. And I mentioned the event for the folks in Haiti Thursday at the Renaissance. If you're not going there, at the old governor's mansion, you can meet the delightful Marianne Sternberg, or if you have met her, say hello to her again. There is an event that she will be participating in. And 6 o'clock, isn't that when it all starts, Thursday evening at the...
Yes, thanks for having me, Jim.
Well, thanks.
They're doing the reception first. The, you know, Foundation for Historic Louisiana does a series of kind of history culture speakers. And so I'm going to be the speaker Thursday night. They have a reception at 6, and then I'll give a little talk about 6:30. And then if anybody wants to buy either River Road Rambler or the third edition of Along the River Road, which I have also just finished and LSU Press produced, that will be available as well.
Well, you are the River Road expert, and Rita Grimsley Johnson has been with us several times on this show, and whose column appears in The Advocate, author of Poor Man's Provence and Hank Hung the Moon, says Marianne Sternberg guides us to that rare intersection of lively writing and intellectual curiosity in her book about Louisiana's famous River Road. Many travel it, few see it this well, from a convent grotto, the charred remains of sugarcane, to a museum that explains what life was like at Carville's home for those once called lepers. The author finds new information along this old romantic road. You're keeping it alive for those who haven't traveled River Road. Marianne is one who knows it well. You probably know every nook and cranny along the way.
I wouldn't claim to know every nook and cranny. There are too many of them, but I certainly have explored for 20 years and written about a good many things out there. And the latest book, The River Road Rambler, is kind of the culmination of 20 years of traveling around. And I realized that there were things out there, places that were unique, or that they were really, really unusual and under-recognized. So I collected 15 of them in this book, which is essays and sketches. It's called River Road Rambler, which is supposed to be me, but I'm encouraging everybody to be a River Road Rambler and explore for themselves. There's a lot out there to see. There are places to stay, lots of places to eat. And, you know, we need to appreciate what's right out of our back door, as it were.
297-5633 is your number, and I'm sure many of those listening have traveled River Road. It's been a while since I've gone all the way from Baton Rouge to New Orleans. How long does it take when you go the route on River Road?
Well, if you drive straight and don't stop, probably take maybe 2 hours. But I don't see how you can do it without stopping myself. There's too much to see and do. And, of course, the road's on both sides of the river. So when you say when I go, I guess you're going to stick to the East Bank, but don't forget the West Bank also.
Well, we have a beautiful state, and River Road is an example of that. As Buddy Romer said in his inaugural address 25 years ago, we have the purtiest state in America. And River Road is spectacular. 15 sketches from sites along the route are featured in River Road Rambler, including the aforementioned National Hansen's Disease Center at Carville. That is truly a historic landmark for our state and our country.
Absolutely. It is truly unique because there was not another institution that dealt with patients with Hansen's disease in the continental United States. And it was the home for these people and for research about the disease for over a century. And, of course, it was turned over in 1999 to the National Guard, and so it's got another use right now. But there's still several patients that are there because they had no place else to go when everyone was allowed to leave. And the museum there tells the story of the place. You can take a little driving tour. There's a diagram that you follow. And it's a remarkable, it's a beautiful campus besides which. And it's a remarkable story which you see at the museum. And then I talk to this elderly man who's been there for since the 1950s. I mean, almost all of his life, and got a perspective.
Years.
Yeah, got a perspective on his life there and how he saw it. So I didn't, you know, just do research. I was on the ground, being a rambler, as it were.
How did you develop this passion? You've written a couple of books now about River Road, but it's something that touches you in any number of ways.
Well, I really love Louisiana history and culture. And when I wrote the first along the River Road, the first edition. It was because I had discovered that there was a great deal more out in the area than the casual visitor could see. And that was because there wasn't much signage, and there wasn't an easy way to find it out. And, of course, that's the reason that we're now at Along the River Road, third edition, which, as I said, just came out with Rambler, because people will, I hope, want to continue to take the other book and pick it up and travel the road with it and see what's out there, because the signage, while a little bit better than it was 20 years ago, still isn't what it should be.
You go to Our Lady of the Lourdes in Convent. This place is probably not known as well as, say, the Hansen's Disease Center, but another nugget of beauty and splendor along River Road.
Beauty, splendor, and actually it's kind of vernacular art or vernacular expression. Mm-hmm. The grotto, which is in a chapel, the rock wall, instead of being made of rocks, which we don't have, is made of bagasse clinkers, which, of course, is a residue from processing sugarcane. And
Isn't that something?
Well, it is. And this, I think, is apparently the only Our Lady of Lourdes grotto that is inside in mm-hmm. all of the world. Most of them are outside. Anyway, it was enough different that I wanted to find out what the story was on it. And it's quite charming, and there are still many pilgrims who go to the chapel, to the grotto, to have their prayers heard. So it's a special, very special place.
877-217-5757 for Marianne Sternberg. Doug on Interstate 10. Doug, good morning. You're on the air with Marianne.
Good morning, Jim and Dr. Sternberg. I'm delighted to hear this topic. It's very welcome and timely. And, one of the interests I have is trying to see what of the landscape along the River Road can be protected, and it's a notion that a lot of our local officials still find incomprehensible, but I think it's worthy of trying, because once it's gone, it's gone. So in addition to the historical sites, the landscape itself is something that's a real amenity for our area.
What about erosion and how River Road in the next generation could conceivably be washed away?
Well, I think I have to give the Corps of Engineers a lot of credit. They seem to be keeping the levee along the river well maintained. And the landscape, of course, has it's differed. It's changed for the 300 years of documented history. Now, of course, you know, there's sugarcane fields where there may used to have been a house. There may be a house where there used to be sugarcane fields. There may be industry where there used to be a plantation. But it's a very mixed landscape, and mm-hmm. he's right. There's certainly buildings and historical sites and cultural sites that we hope will be protected and maintained.
The book is River Road Rambler, A Curious Traveler Along Louisiana's Historic Byway. And speaking of the landscape, you go to one of the most prominent gardens in the world, established and abandoned in the mid-19th century. How was that experience?
Well, it was one of the most prominent gardens. It is now private. It's a forest. It's behind a fence. And I found the owner and got him to take me through it a couple of times, because in the mid-19th century, the Valcarême Garden was known as Le Petit Versailles. It was extraordinary. Exotic plants and interesting landscaping and follies and all sorts of things. And the story about what happened to it and what's left was quite wonderful. In terms of tromping, which was what we did through that garden with the owner as my guide, mm-hmm. I also am a big fan of the bacher between the levee and the river. And so in many places, a bacher is like a little wilderness park. And if you can have access to it, You can go down and explore, which is how I first got introduced to it 40 years ago.
You discover what is and reflect on what was, including a fire that razed the cottage plantation. Tell us about that.
Well, when I moved to Baton Rouge about 45 years ago, everybody knew about the cottage. It had only just burned within the last 10 years. And now the columns are standing on Conrad Point, but not many people know what they mean anymore. Not many people realize that they are all that's left from the cottage plantation, which was a gorgeous plantation and had a wonderful history. And so I wanted to sort of introduce this to readers so mm-hmm. they'd know what that was. You know, you're driving down the river road and there are these columns in the middle of a pasture. And what are they? And that's what they are. But how did they get there? What mm-hmm. do they mean? And so forth.
What about the Destrehan Plantation?
Destrehan, of course, is open to the public, and it's a wonderful plantation. But I wrote about it because it struck me that it had a very interesting juxtaposition of activities on it in the 19th century. It was the site of the tribunal for the 1811 slave rebellion. And Mr. Destrehan of the plantation, along with several other planters, sat in judgment on the slave leaders and sent them to their death, had them beheaded and their heads piked on the river road. And historians have subsequently read the minutes of that tribunal and decided that justice wasn't really done. But within 50 years or so, Destrehan was then the site of an agency of the Freedmen's Bureau, and emancipated slaves were brought to Destrehan to be fed and clothed and taken care of and taught how to respond in their new freedom, how to exist in a capitalist society, which they wouldn't have known how to do as slaves. So I just found that interesting. And Destrehan has, they have a wonderful art exhibit that shows the slave rebellion. And then they have a room dedicated to its time as the Freedmen's Bureau. So they accept and recognize this interesting juxtaposition mm-hmm. in their history.
In your next to last chapter, you say you're allowed to call me a hypocrite. You're talking about tobacco.
Oh, yes. Well, Perique tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
Perique tobacco is, of course, only grown along the river road. And I say call me a hypocrite because I haven't ever smoked. And so I know that tobacco is very dangerous. On the other hand, this is a very colorful tradition, and so I'm writing about it because it is a tradition, and it's a legend out there, and it's got a fascinating story, and it nearly disappeared because nobody was farming it commercially, and then all of a sudden it's come back a bit. So part of the story was the history and where it came from, and part of the story is how is it now? Who brought it back? What's happening? And, you know, I still don't smoke.
In your final chapter, you go to Gramercy, a historic town, one that some would say is forgotten, but it's still there, and you find some information that I think is quite enlightening. Anatomy of a company town.
Well, company towns were quite prevalent along the river road in the late 19th and early 20th century, when businesses were setting up shop and there weren't enough people around, so they set up company towns, which meant that the business established housing and schooling and entertainment and everything. And the Colonial Sugars Historic District is the last of its kind on the River Road. It's the last company town for the sugar industry in the country, which I guess would make it unique. And the refinery's still going after 100 years. It's still out there. They have a new refinery, but it's on site. And there are some of the historic buildings, but the site itself is closed to the public. So I had to wangle an invitation in and get a tour and see what was there, and then talk to people who lived there when it was a company town so that people would understand what it was like to live in a place like that.
The book is River Road Rambler, A Curious Traveler Along Louisiana's Historic Byway, from Marianne Sternberg. It will be at the Old Governor's Mansion as part of a production from the Foundation for Historical Louisiana this Thursday. 6 o'clock is when it starts. Marianne will speak at about 6:30. Neil White, author of the book In the Sanctuary of Outcasts, has been on this show, says, "Our best tour guides are great storytellers, and none is better than Marianne Sternberg." Thank you, Marianne.
Thank you, Jim.
And congratulations
Thank
on the fine
very
book
much.
From LSU Press.
Thank you so much.
River Road Rambler. That's it for today, and we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.